Good morning and welcome to the Tuesday edition of the KRFY Morning Show. This is your morning show host, Julie Calamine, and I'm joined by my co-host, Phil Huff. Good morning, Phil.
Morning, Julie.
How are you?
Well, warm now after being inside for about 30 minutes.
Oh, no kidding. It is so chilly out, and we're happy to be in our warm studio that tends to be on the warm side.
Yeah, if you don't have to go out, don't go out. It's the roads are slick and icy, and it's better just to not travel too much on them.
So true. There was even a blockage on the Long Bridge yesterday. It prevented me from getting to town, but now, of course, clear it away.
But if you do go out, there's wonderful snow to go skiing, snowshoeing, cross-country skiing. Did you get out and do any fun this weekend, Julie?
I did get out a bit, but you may hear it. I'm still recovering slightly from my cold. You know, Phil, you saw me this weekend at the keg pull.
I was going to say, that was Dexter running, wasn't it?
That was little Dexter.
How did you?
He made a valiant effort. You saw him, and he ran. I don't think he was the winner, though. In the 10-pound category, it gets pretty competitive.
He did good.
Yes, thank you.
But then everyone who shows up is a winner. It's a great benefit for the shelter.
So true. I think they probably had an excellent benefit because there were many competitors, everyone donating to the event. Very good. Well, this does bring us to weather. Let's talk about weather, and then we'll introduce our guests. We've got great guests this morning. Today, it's beautiful. If you've looked out your window yet, sunny, very chilly, and kind of windy. A high today of 23, and windy and beautiful, but chilly. So if you get out there, dress up warmly. Low tonight of 9. Tomorrow, we're seeing snow again, Phil. A high of 29, and it's a 60% chance of snow. So we'll likely get a bit then. Low of 19, Thursday, more of the same. 60% chance of snow and a high of 33. Thursday night, 20. Friday, 31, and a good chance of rain, snow showers.
Not rain.
Snow showers. I saw showers and I was thinking rain.
So March is going to roar in kind of like a cold lion.
It seems so. Yeah. It doesn't seem like fishing weather, Phil, but that's what we're talking about today.
It does. And we're going to get there. I don't want to give away the end, but winter fishing for burbot.
Say it correctly.
Burbot.
Like ribbit. Burbot. Yeah. We got a lesson in that as we met our guests. Our guests this morning are TJ Ross, who is the Senior Fishery Research Biologist with Idaho Fish and Game. Good morning, TJ.
Good morning.
So happy to have you here. And Sean Young. Sean is with the Kootenai Tribe Aquaculture Program. He's the manager. Good morning, Sean.
Good morning.
So happy to have you both here this morning. We're talking, as Phil just said, about burbot. And it's not burbot. No. But it's many other things. Tell us some of the names for burbot.
There's a variety of names. We call it burbot here in the Panhandle. Some other common names that you might hear are ling cod, freshwater cod, eel pout. I just learned today that in Minnesota they can call them dogfish.
True.
Something new I hadn't heard. Anything to add to that, Sean?
When I was in school in Wisconsin, they had some other names, lawyers, codfish, you know, lots of different things. They didn't have quite the same respect that, you know, the folks have for that fish around here.
I think there's a lot of fish that carry those last two names. So we'll stick with burbot to clarify things. Why don't you give us a little bit of background on each of you and how you ended up here in the Panhandle doing the work you do. And Sean, let's start with you.
Yeah, thanks. I ended up in the Bonners Ferry area because after I finished my 4-year degree in Wisconsin, I was hired to be a technician by Idaho Fish and Game. And I started out in Lewiston doing snorkel surveys, and then I got hired on to do the winter burbot surveys. I think it was the winter 97, 98. And after that, I stayed on to work on rainbow trout, white sturgeon for a few years. And then I decided to go to grad school, so I went back east to Clemson University and got a PhD there and worked different places, taught at a few different schools, and eventually made my way back out here and took the full-time position with the Kootenai Tribe in 2011. And it was a good decision, and that's how I ended up in Bonners Ferry.
Nice.
And what are some of the things you work on when you're not working on burbot?
We also have the white sturgeon program. We have the large-scale habitat restoration programs. all the projects that have gone on around Bonner's Ferry, and we have plans to move down into some big projects down in the valley towards the Wildlife Refuge, Ball Creek Ranch, the Smith Boundary State Wildlife Management Area, and also on the Kootenai Tribe's Nims Ranch property. We have some really great projects going on.
All related to fishing.
Yeah.
Yes.
And sturgeon and burbot and trout and
yeah, trying to bring back, you know, the whole fish assemblage community along with the general ecosystem as much as possible.
There's a lot we can talk about and unpack there. I want to look a little bit too at how the work on the burbot affects some of the other species recoveries, but let's hear a little bit more about your background, TJ.
Yeah, I think first I'd like to thank you guys for asking us to be on the show. This is pretty exciting. I know I speak for Sean and everybody else involved with this project when I say that we think about burbot a lot. We talk about burbot a lot, so it's cool to be able to be here to share that story with everyone. So thanks for the opportunity. My name's TJ, and I've been with Idaho Fish and Game for about 7 years now. This November will be 7 years. prior to working for Fish and Game, I was born and raised in Oklahoma. I spent 23 years of my life in Oklahoma, and was actually going to undergraduate to become a physical therapist. And while I was studying to be a physical therapist, one summer I took a job at a fish hatchery, and had a revelation that summer that I could actually make a living playing with fish.
The things that happen when we're fishing and learning about fish changes lives.
Totally. So, you know, from there, I started to pursue that career path and went to graduate school in upstate New York for 3 years, spent a short stint working in Michigan, and then my wife and I had always dreamed about living out west with Idaho and Montana being at the top of our list. And was offered the job with Fish and Game in Coeur d'Alene, and we've never looked back. It's been it's been an awesome journey. We're very, very thankful to be here.
And when you're not working on burbot, what are some of the other projects you get involved with?
Work projects or life or all of the above?
Or both, sure.
Yeah, so I guess right now most of my life is consumed with raising kids. I've got three kids ages 6 and under, so life is
busy.
It's awesome. Wouldn't have it any other way. and then outside of that, I'm involved with a lot of the stuff that Sean mentioned. He and I work really closely on pretty much all of those projects relative to trying to improve fishing on the Kootenai River specifically.
And is your main project the burbot at this time?
It is. Burbot, nice. And then I do a fair amount of work with rainbow trout also.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Well, let's move on to the burbot. It's burbot, freshwater cod, many other names, but why don't we ask you to tell us a bit about this fish and why it's important?
Totally. It's a great question. So we covered some of the other names, but it literally is what you just said. It's a freshwater cod. You know, so they're from the same family as like an ocean-dwelling cod, but they live in freshwater, so they're pretty unique in that regard. And, you know, I think I'm obviously biased in how I think about burbot because I'm a burbot biologist, but I would venture to say that they are one of, if not the coolest fish in Idaho. But again, I'm biased, but they're pretty awesome.
So tell us what makes them cool.
Sure. I've got a few things I think that I can highlight that people may or may not know about burbot. If you've never seen one in person, first time you see one, it may be a bit intimidating.
Shocking, really.
Yeah, and you may not know what you just caught. So the way that I think a good description of a burbot is it's like a mix between a catfish, an eel, a snake, a salamander, and a leopard. It's this interesting combination. Sean's shaking his head yes here because he is agreeing
with
me.
They're pretty cool.
Yeah, and
much different.
Yeah, the reason I say that is they're slimy. Like a catfish, they don't have scales. They've just got slimy skin, and they've got a lot of brownish, grayish, greenish, leopard-like patterns all over their body. And they actually have a little, looks like a whisker. It's called a barbel. on the bottom of their chin, so similar to a catfish.
Not stinging, is it?
No.
Good.
Not stinging. It just kind of dangles there. So they really, they look more like an eel than anything else. Something else that's interesting about them is they can actually get pretty big. In the Kootenai River, we've seen them up to 13 to 15 pounds, pushing 3 feet long. They can get a lot bigger than that in other parts of the nation, but these are fish that can put on some size. And then I'll also put a plug in that burbot are very well known for the quality of their meat. Mm-hmm. So they're known to have, you know, think of cod meat, crystal white, beautiful, delicious meat. So that's another quality of burbot.
Tell us a little bit about their range. We're going to talk about the where why they're important to the Kootenai area and the Kootenai River and their recovery. But where's their native range?
Yeah, so burbot are actually found all around the northern latitudes of the, you know, the whole way around the world through North America, Europe, and Asia, Eurasia, Russia. So they're widely distributed, but they only go so far south because of temperature. So they need mostly cold river streams. So as you go too far south, it starts to warm up and it's too temperate for them. And so, like in Idaho, they're only native to the Kootenai River and then also in the upper Columbia. But if you go too far down the Columbia or too far down into Idaho, some of the river systems were likely just a little too warm for them. And that's about the latitude the whole way around the globe. Mm-hmm. The northern United States, the Great Lakes, all through Canada, Alaska, mm-hmm. and then sort of the same latitudes across Europe and Russia.
Mm-hmm. And is it the same species everywhere? Is it the same burbot in Russia as it is here in the U.S.?
We consider them the same species, but there's a couple of different subspecies depending on the continent that they have some slight differences. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, why is the burbot important? Why should we care about this strange-looking fish? We know it's delicious. That's one reason to care. But why else?
Well, for the folks that I work with, the Kootenai tribe, and a lot of the other native cultures in the Kootenai Basin, in the Upper Columbia Basin, burbot were very important because they were a winter food source. Because of the way burbot behave in their life history, you know, they're one of the few fish that are very active in the winter, and they congregate for these big spawning balls in shallow habitats. So they were accessible for a winter food source, and so that was really important for a very long time.
So tell us a little bit about their history here in the Kootenai River and in the region. It sounds like they have been here, and if we're talking recovery, something must have happened.
Yes, so the burbot have been around for considerable time, just geologically, and it looks like they kind of ebbed and flowed. You know, they invaded from the salt waters, their relatives, the other saltwater cods, and they come into the fresh waters, and with the ice ages, they kind of come and go. And then when folks, came into North America and settled into this region, you know, a long time ago, a lot of the native cultures in this area relied on fish quite heavily at different times of the year. And so that persisted until, you know, very recent. And also then when the settlers moved in, they also realized the same thing. If you're in these heavy Rocky Mount winters and you're short on food, they sort of learned from the native cultures and also realized, you know, these burbot are available and they're become pretty important to folks moving into the region. And then over time, though, priorities sort of changed as folks moved into the region and started developing agriculture and changing the rivers with the dikes and such, and then put in Libby Dam to control the floods and for other purposes and modernize our society. And those effects have accumulated to where the burbot pretty much were all but gone. Just until we started the hatchery programs.
So the impact on them, partly from overfishing and partly from alteration of habitat, drove them into a deep decline.
Yeah, altering the habitats are a major issue. usually habitat alterations are what drive ultimate extinctions or extirpations. Overfishing definitely has effects on fish populations, but it's usually environmental changes that really drive mm-hmm. them towards, mm-hmm. Complete disappearing.
And did this, the establishment of dams change spawning habitat? Was that the issue, TJ?
Yeah, that was some of it. I mean, we're still trying to figure out exactly what that is. I think it's a combination of multiple things. The dam operations changing flows and river temperatures, potential overfishing in some areas. I mean, and it got to the point in the early 2000s, Fish and Game had done some studies and estimated that there were actually fewer than 50 individual burbot left in the river.
Oh, my.
Yeah, so really dire circumstances. I mean, almost to the point of extinction, clearly. And so that, kind of something had to happen. Something had to change or it was going to be a lost resource.
So did that low a number trigger some discussion of having them placed on the threatened and endangered species list?
It did. Yeah, there's a lot of that discussion floating around. And thankfully, and Sean, you may be able to speak to this more, but rather than going down the endangered species route, which comes with a lot of hurdles, there was a community effort led by the Kootenai Valley Resource Initiative to basically circumvent ESA by coming up with a conservation strategy. And that took place in 2005 with the idea that, hey, maybe we can do this without going down the ESA route and get back to where we are now much quicker.
And so the work began around 2005 to assist their recovery, and we want to go into that. How closely tied into that is the work with the recovery of the sturgeon?
They're pretty much mutual. Mm-hmm. A lot of the fish in the ecosystem in general basically are, they have adapted and evolved together over all the years. And so they basically have all suffered mm-hmm. in very similar ways. And so that's one of the premises around the habitat restoration and trying to figure out how to possibly manage the river differently or maybe more better with Libby Dam's presence. If you help one species, you're likely helping all the species because, again, they were all part of this ecosystem for a very long time, thriving together. And so that's sort of the premise behind most of, the Kootenai tribe and a lot of the working groups for all these different projects.
So let's talk about the working groups. It's obviously takes a combined effort, and we have this morning from folks, the two of you from Idaho Fish and Game of the Kootenai Tribe of Idaho. Tell us about who else is involved and how you all work together.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, just in general, I think I'll preface that with, this project and where we are now wouldn't happen without the collaborative nature of it. Like, Fish and Game couldn't do what we do without the Kootenai Tribe, and likewise, it's a heavily collaborative project and a lot of fun because of that. We're making a lot of progress because of that. And some of the other entities that are involved are Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, folks from British Columbia, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, locals in Boundary County, county commissioners. And
Bonneville Power Administration.
Absolutely.
They're key to it all. They provide a substantial amount of the funding, which is super important when you try to, implement and be successful with these big projects.
That's quite a group when you mention who's involved, and it's sort of a multi-pronged approach from what I can see. We've got hatcheries, we've got habitat improvement, and more. Tell us about the elements of the recovery project.
Well, I'll start with our hatcheries. So for the burbot recovery, it sort of started even before the KVRI Burbot Conservation Strategy. Fish and Game had done extensive monitoring post-Libby Dam for quite some time and showed that the burbot were pretty much gone. And the Kootenai Tribe, of course, that concerned them. They had started the white sturgeon program and decided we would like to investigate starting our burbot aquaculture program. Burbot are, in my career, they're the most difficult fish to aquaculture. They have a pretty complicated life history. And they're fairly sensitive in the early life stages during egg and larval stages. And so you need a substantial facility and know-how. And so in the beginning, folks turned to the University of Idaho to try to complete the whole cycle. Can you spawn and then rear burbot for releases to actually, you know, try to be successful in this recovery? And that started like in 2003 and went through about 2014. So they were doing a lot of the burbot culture, learned the techniques, disease testing, all the important aspects. And then during that time, the Kootenai tribe, we designed, constructed, and completed a new facility at Twin Rivers. And since then, we've been able to scale up. And with that new facility, we just built in a lot of capabilities that a lot of facilities don't have.
So these are specialized hatcheries just for the burbot, or intended primarily for the burbot, at least?
Our new facility at Twin Rivers, actually, we have white sturgeon and burbot under the same roof. Essentially, we built two hatcheries under one roof, and we just kind of isolate the two species and their life history, but in the same hatchery.
In order to go through the propagation, are you going out and trying to collect some of those last 50 individual fish, or are you augmenting from burbot somewhere else, or both?
Yeah, that's a great question, Phil. So originally, to get brood stock for the hatchery, there was a collaborative effort working with folks from British Columbia to actually go up to Moya Lake near Cranbrook and go out on the ice. A group of folks from Fish and Game, from BC, and from KTOI, Kootenai Tribe, and ice fish.
A big ice fishing
ice
trip.
Ice fish, yeah.
Fun.
To collect these burbot with, and then the burbot come out of the ice, and all the spawning actually takes place on the ice. So the eggs are collected and fertilized on the ice, and each night, folks from KTOI would travel back to the hatchery, drop off the eggs, and begin the
Now, that's not how they naturally do it, right?
This no.
is an imposed order.
Typically below the surface of the water, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And those fish were from BC, but you've already mentioned that the species are very similar, so you must have felt confident that they would be a good fit for the Kootenai.
Yeah, there was so Fish and Game did some genetic analyses to support
And for
that.
Those unfamiliar with the area, it sounds like at least it's in the same basic watershed, the Moya Lake.
Correct, yep.
Very good.
Yeah, and so now we've actually entered into a phase of the program where we're collecting adults from the river, the Kootenai River itself, and then providing those to KTOI, and they do all of the spawning in hatchery. So we're kind of in a transition where we're still collecting fish from Moya Lake, but also doing some from the river and transitioning to a new phase of the program.
So in the arc of recovery efforts here, roughly 14, 15 years ago, down to about 50, and want to explore how we got there, but just give us some context. Where are we at now?
Sure. I'll just give you the number. Based on the most recent estimates that we have, it's 40 to 50,000 burbot in the river.
That's
so
really amazing. 50 to 50,000 in just less than two decades.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's what's been so fun about this project is it's been super dynamic and quick. It's been quick.
So tell us about some of the benchmarks along the way, how you achieve that success, how you're measuring it, and know you're actually getting there.
Yeah. So as far as Fish and Game's role in this, we do all the in-river monitoring. So I work in Coeur d'Alene, but I have a crew that is headquartered out of Bonner's Ferry. And they spend December 1st through the end of March every year out on a boat setting and pulling. They're called hoop nets. They're long cylindrical nets. With the intent of capturing burbot. So capture these burbot, we collect genetic samples, we put tags in them, we measure them, we weigh them, we do a variety of different, you know, things when we handle these burbot with the ultimate goal of, you know, being able to estimate the number of burbot that are in the river, how well they're surviving, how well they're growing.
Mm-hmm. And so, do you collect eggs at that time?
We don't.
No. No. Okay.
So with the augmentation of the population through the I'll call it captive breeding. I'm not sure if that's the right term, but essentially you're bringing them in, you're augmenting them through the fisheries, you're allowing them to propagate. The decline that was seen because of habitat loss or change during this time period, tell us about how you're working on the habitat improvements to make this sustainable.
Yeah, that's a great question. Through the different working groups and the different projects, you know, we all just work together and we bring our different expertise into it. And so, like, for the Burbot, they have the complicated life history where they need cold water to incubate through the winter. And then when they hatch in late March in the first half of April, most people don't realize that they're incredibly small. Like, you can barely see them with your eye. But they don't have much yolk sac, so within about 7 to 10 days after hatch, they form a mouth and a gut. And they need to feed on plankton almost immediately. And I'm talking, you know, the microscopic plankton community. And that's super important. If they don't have that in the water column, they starve quickly and it could be total loss. And we suspect that's a big problem in the Kootenai because it has an altered ecosystem with reduced nutrients. The main channel's not very productive in terms of food web. And also, Libby Dam keeps the spring temperatures colder than they should be. So instead of that river in the off-channel habitat being connected and warming up, you know, with Libby Dam, it stays colder than it should. And that really causes a big problem for a lot of the early life of a lot of the fish species. So that is sort of our emphasis moving forward in the Kootenai Valley, is trying to remedy that situation to overcome those bottlenecks.
Are you able to do that with the way that the Army Corps releases water from the Libby Dam, get them to adjust it in some manner that assists this?
We're working together to try to find the best way possible. But because of that big slug of water, it's proving to be quite difficult. So we're trying to form our habitat projects around reconnections and off-channel habitats, because those habitats can warm quicker, provide zooplankton early in the spring. And if the fish could just get into those types of habitats through those big projects, we're hoping that will make the difference.
Those sound like excavation projects, but you also have worked with adding nutrients to the Kootenai. TJ?
Yeah, so that's a project that started back in 2005, and that wasn't necessarily geared toward burbot or sturgeon, but just in general improving the productivity of the river. And so there, for those of you that aren't familiar with it, at the Idaho-Montana border, the Kootenai Tribe of Idaho and Idaho Fish and Game work collaboratively to actually add liquid phosphorus to the Kootenai River to improve productivity and improve fishing opportunities.
Yeah, and that's not something we typically think of as a good thing, right? Adding phosphorus to our waterways. But in the case of the Kootenai, it's necessary.
Yeah. Talking with folks that I used to work with back east, when I mentioned we were adding nutrients, I got some very odd looks from them because it is very counterintuitive.
Yes, we worry about too many nutrients so often. It's interesting. Well, why don't you give us an idea of goalposts or what your goals are for the burbot and maybe for the sturgeon, too?
For the burbot program in general?
Yes, right.
Yeah,
what
totally.
Are populations? What are we? What's the overall goal? What are you shooting for?
Yeah, so I think I can speak to burbot. To burbot, there's really two overarching goals that we've been focused on since the conservation strategy was developed in 2005. And the first goal is to restore the population such that it is self-sustaining, meaning that burbot are naturally spawning and reproducing in the river with the ideal scenario where the hatchery operations are no longer needed, that burbot are doing it on their own. So that's the first component. The second would be restore the population to a level that it can support some level of harvest.
Yes, and is there a number? Is there a figure that you're shooting for?
There is. So what's outlined in the strategy is an adult abundance of 17,500 for the adults, which as of 2019 we have exceeded that number.
And eventually, I would imagine that the goal or hope is to have that sustainable without the assistance of the hatchery rearings.
Yeah, absolutely.
And do you see it as, I mean, you must see that as a possibility with this fast success.
It is a possibility. Last year, we identified that we did get some natural recruitment. So in the HootNet surveys, Idaho Fish and Game, TJ and his staff take fin clips, and they monitor these individuals tracking genetics. So in the hatcheries, we take very specific groups of the burbot we rear, and we keep them in these family groups, which means they have X parents. And if we keep track of that, then when we release fish in very specific places in time, and, you know, by year class, when they're recaptured in those hoop nets, then TJ and his staff can tell us that fish was from 2015. You guys, Kootenai Tribe, released it, say, at Bonner's Ferry in October. Or if we do experimental larval releases, you released it at the Port Hill at the border in May of 2015. And we are learning, you know, a ton about the different areas of the river and the different life stages that are surviving and contributing to, you know, this new population. And that really has been a key component to understanding the whole project. But we still do have a long way to go with implementing these, you know, upcoming habitat projects and kickstarting that natural recruitment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just the increase in numbers, unless it's sustainable, you'd have to be continuing to augment it.
Yeah, eventually, you know, the plan is to not have hatcheries, and that these fish will be spawning and surviving and just reproducing to where they're self-sustaining, you know, into the future. That's everybody's preference.
Well, we've come a long way on learning about fish and reproduction through the technology you're using. We're going to take a short music break and then come back and talk a bit about the burbot fishing season that was opened just this year. If you are just joining us, this is KRFY, listener-supported community radio for the Idaho Panhandle. You're listening to The Morning Show with Julie and Phil, and we're talking with TJ Ross, who's the Senior Fishery Research Biologist with Idaho Fish and Game, and Sean Young, the Program Manager for the Kootenai Tribe's Aquaculture Program. And we're talking about burbot. In honor of the burbot, we're going to have a fishing song. Cisco Houston with Talking Fishing Blues. Well, there it was, Cisco Houston with Talking Fishing Blues. And it sounds like we might not be that blue if we decide to fish for burbot, because they are congregating in the winter. Can one of you, either TJ or Sean, tell us about what's going on with these burbot in the winter?
Yeah, so right now in the dead of winter, you know, and we're having a cold winter, that's good for burbot. We have a lot of ice formation. The water is, you know, really cold, around 2 degrees Celsius, and that is the preferred and prime range for burbot spawning, and their eggs to incubate very well and survive until about April when the spring warm-up occurs. And so right now they're on the move. A lot of them are migrating, looking for each other. And what they do is they just find preferred habitat, usually some gravel, cobble, rock, in shallow areas along the rivers, in the streams, along the lakes. And when a female has a preferred spawning location, it's likely her pheromones and some other activities bring the males in and other burbot, and they'll just come in a big congregation when it's time to spawn, and there could be dozens, 50, 100 burbot all together, and literally they just put their heads down into that substrate and their tails go up into the water, and they just writhe against each other in this big spawning ball until the eggs and the sperm are released and fertilization just occurs in this big cloud all around those fish. And then the eggs will just settle into that gravel cobble substrate to, you know, incubate for about 40-50 days until they hatch.
So it's one great big party.
Pretty much. Yep. Yeah.
Yep. They go far and wide looking for each other.
We might even say an orgy, Phil. Sounds pretty crazy. And you've already described these fish.
I guess we can use that word on the radio.
I think that's legal, hopefully. Yeah. Anyway, and they're a crazy looking fish to begin with. So it must be something to see. Have you both witnessed these fishing, these fish balls?
Yeah, through underwater cameras, particularly on Moye Lake, when we've been collecting broodstock, we've been able to see it. And for any anglers listening, if you ever find yourself fishing and you see a spawning ball or happen to be fishing in the midst of it, you hit the jackpot.
Yeah.
Stay put. It's going to get good.
So I can imagine.
Let's talk about that. There's a fishing season for him this year for the first time, I guess, in quite a while.
Yeah, so it opened January 1st, 2019, and that's after being closed since 1992.
Mm-hmm. So that's going on a long time.
26, 27 years of closure. So it's, you know, as you can imagine, like in our discussions and the different project collaborators, this has been a really exciting process, a really exciting year. So we've been, you know, shooting for this and talking about this, and really in 2017 is when it started to become more of a reality that we were considering, like, hey, in 2019 we're going to meet some restoration goals that would justify us moving into this phase of the project. And so, yeah, to be at this point is super rewarding and been a lot of fun.
And so it was part of the idea that by opening a season, of course, you might increase the interest of the local angling community in the recovery efforts?
For sure. I think that's part of it. And then also the other part, you know, is just to be able to provide opportunity or access to a resource mm-hmm. that was once so valuable to the Kootenai tribe, to people in Bonner's Ferry, and just to be able to reconnect with that.
Mm-hmm. TJ, you've mentioned that there's a season for Idaho residents, and I imagine there are maximum numbers, that sort of thing. Tell us about that. How many burbot can I catch?
Yeah, so I'll give a brief summary of what the regulations look like, and I'll preface it with saying that anybody can find these in the new rule book that was printed for 2019 through 21. So the way it's laid out is the entire Kootenai River and its tributaries are open to burbot fishing and burbot harvest year-round. So there's no seasonal closure, no closure in certain parts of the river, anything like that. So open year-round, and an angler can go out and catch 6 burbot per day, and there's no size restriction. So if an angler catches a burbot, they can harvest it and take it home. And we set the regulations up that way, and we looked at, you know, surrounding states to try to get an idea of what other burbot regulations looked like, and this jived with that. And we figured that obviously it was set so that we would never compromise the restoration goals in the conservation strategy.
Yes, and you'll be able to monitor that, I'm sure. And Sean, does the Kootenai tribe have a different set of regulations, or do they follow the same fish and game for harvest?
In general, the Kootenai tribe has rights. And so essentially, you know, for many years, because the populations of burbot and sturgeon are so low, they were just foregoing any harvest because they wanted to recover the fish to a healthy population before they reinitiated their cultural activities. And so right now, they're sort of just we're glad the opportunities are available again. And some of the folks have gone out to catch some fish, but as of right now, it's pretty low-key, small scale, and certain members are more interested than others. In general, I think it's been pretty close to the general public in the same areas, same number of fish.
Sure, so they're trying to be judicious and help the population recover.
Yeah, that's still our, you know, the main focus, you know, for the whole group, and especially mm-hmm. the tribe. Mm-hmm. I'm really glad the opportunities are there for cultural and for the public, but still, in the end, would like to really see the fish self-sustaining mm-hmm. at that healthy population.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, a lot of fisheries are managed as in various places where you go in and stock mm-hmm. fish every season in certain lakes because the public is interested in fishing, but it's not self-sustaining without that stocking program, and that's not what the goal is here.
Right. Yeah, and I think we're just in a phase of when we look at the adult abundance, we've hit that restoration target. Mm-hmm. And so we're at that point where it's like, well, it seems appropriate to open this fishery. There's the biological meaning. It's meaningful, and it's possible without compromising the, mm-hmm. the overall goals of the program.
Well, I'm interested in knowing if you're getting reports back from fishermen. Are you all involved with that area, or is that a different part of fish and game? What are you hearing about harvests?
Yeah, we are certainly involved in that. One of the agreements when talking among our groups with opening this fishery was that Fish and Game would very extensively conduct what's called a creel survey. So that entails going out, you know, middle of the night, early morning, afternoon, whatever it is, and doing angler counts and angler interviews to get a handle on what's happening in the fishery. And so we are actively doing that. We've been doing it for going on 2 months now. And so far, just to give some general numbers, we've conducted interviews with close to 600 anglers, which equates to roughly 2,000 hours of angler effort. What we're seeing is that catch rates so far are relatively low, but well within the bounds of what we would consider like acceptable or sustainable for the recovery goals. So all things considered, it's operating in the way that we had hoped, but I think exceeding our expectations in terms of how people are engaging with it. Like, people are loving it.
They are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tell me when they're fishing. I have a note here that middle of the night in the dead of winter may not be my ideal fishing conditions. Is that when people are fishing, or are they fishing daytime, nighttime? Sean, when are people fishing?
People are fishing all the time right now.
And is nighttime generally more successful, or not necessarily?
From what I'm hearing from a lot of different folks, it's just kind of hit or miss, and that's the nature of burbot, that if they're active and they're feeding, you can pretty much catch them any time of the day. But then they go through these lulls where they're not so active and not feeding that much, and then, you know, you just kind of have to wait that out until they're active again. So I've talked to a lot of different folks, and some people are swearing by the evening, some people swear by first thing in the morning, some build fires at night. So, you know, it's kind of just like any fisherman.
Usually they're not telling.
Yeah. So, yeah, you're not sure if they're telling the truth, but usually if something works, you know, you stick with it, and that's your thing. And so I think it just depends on the angler.
Tell us generally how they are fished for. I'm imagining if their primary food is plankton, that's a really, really tiny piece of bait.
Yeah, so plankton would be for the, like, a newly hatched burbot. So like the adult burbot, they feed on other fish. And so most anglers that we've spoken with, because that's a question we ask when we're doing an angler interview, is what are you fishing with? How are you doing it? And most anglers are fishing with some form of cut bait. So they'll have a fish, they'll cut it into small pieces and put it on the hook. They might be using worms, squid, shrimp, herring, you name it. If it's kind of along those lines, if it's stinky and it's on the bottom of the river, burbot might swim by and smell it and decide to gulp it down. So that's most of what we're hearing. And burbot are bottom-dwelling fish, so guys are fishing on the bottom of the river, kind of passively waiting for burbot to swim by, kind of like fishing for catfish.
Sounds like catfish
Very
fishing.
Very similar to catfish fishing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's probably not a fly fishing activity.
I don't think you would experience much success with that. Yep.
Very funny. All right. Well, I'm also interested in knowing just a little bit more about the edibility of burbot. So we haven't really talked about them other than that they're delicious, but I read a bit that they're delicious. So there are certain parts of them that folks look for in terms of eating them and harvesting them.
Yeah. So I'm ashamed and embarrassed to say I have never eaten a burbot.
Mm.
I've handled like hundreds or thousands of them, but haven't actually eaten one. But I will say, like, all the folks that I've talked to locally and surrounding states, like, they just rave about the quality of the meat. Again, freshwater cod, like I mentioned earlier.
It sounds yummy.
Yeah. I mean, it's like cod meat. Yeah.
And you've admitted something, TJ. I'm going to admit something now, too. As most of you would know, I'm from Minnesota, and there are burbot in the northern lakes there. And as we've already mentioned, they have a number of different names, and they're not very attractive fish. So my family never ate a single burbot. We caught them, and you will probably be unhappy to hear this, but we buried them in our vegetable garden, guys. We just buried them.
That sounds borderline sinful.
Yeah. I think so. I think it was a mistake. So not to happen with me again.
Cultural misunderstanding.
I think so. Anyway, well, it sounds like a great success story, and recovery is moving forward, and you've all collaborated and worked together. It's just a great project. We're wrapping up our interview time, so any last comments? maybe contact info if people would want to get to know more about Burbot, where they could go or who they could chat with.
Yeah, I can start us off. I've
sure.
just got a few thoughts to conclude. Yeah. I love talking about Burbot. And anytime I talk with anglers or anybody interested in it, I am more than happy to give my number, my email. Even if guys and gals just want to call and tell me their experience on the river, I love hearing that stuff. So can I give my phone
of
number?
Of course. Yes.
Yeah, if anybody wants to reach me, call me at the Coeur d'Alene office, which is 208-769-1414. And you can ask for me. And like I said, happy to talk about Burbot anytime. I think about Burbot all the time. So.
All right. So they would ask for TJ Ross.
They would ask for TJ Ross, mm-hmm. right.
And Sean, any last comments?
From the Kootenai tribe perspective, and from my perspective, I would just like to finish by thanking all the technicians that have worked on the projects at the U of I, at, you know, the Kootenai tribe facilities, the Idaho Fish and Game technicians that go out, and all these folks working in the dead of winter. It's cold, snowy, wet. Burbot are kind of stinky and slimy. they're difficult to aquaculture. You know, you got to show up day in and day out to keep the hatcheries operating, make sure the fish are getting what they need, because they have this complicated life history where they change multiple times. And to make all that work just takes a lot of dedication and hard work. And without those folks showing up every day, we wouldn't be where we are right now.
I must say, the stinky and slimy recommends them more for the compost pile than the dinner plate.
But they taste great.
They do taste great. They are a little stinky and slimy. And in the dead of winter, you know, your hands are freezing. And, you know, it's just, again, a lot of hard work. And it takes that love and dedication for what you do to make it all go. Yeah. So I thank everybody.
Thank you both for coming in this morning and sharing all the information on Burbot.
Yes, and I thank you as well, TJ Ross and Sean Young from the Kootenai Tribe. And we're going to go to a song break and then come back with some upcoming events. And I just appreciate your enthusiasm. Thank you, guys.
Yeah, you're welcome.
All right, so we'll be